Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have four matters on our calendar today. Three of those are oral. We have concluded arguments in the first matter and we're ready for the second. I see the lawyers are visible and on the screen. So I'll ask the marshal to call the second case.
Now calling A20-1640, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Sermor Rio Boaki Appellant.
All right, and counsel, I know you've already had your audio and visual checked. We've also heard you speak just briefly. You, of course, have some instructions on what to do if by chance you do lose connections with the court or are unable to hear each other. And so I assume you'll follow through with that. We are fortunate to be proceeding with these orals today via Zoom in light of the current pandemic. We are recording these proceedings. And so as a result, I will ask you to identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent before you start your remarks. That just makes our recording very clear. The recording will later be available on the court's website, the audio recording. No other recording is allowed. Now, with that, I want to remind you to also keep your eye on the portion of the screen that shows the clock. We will have a conversation, which we very much look forward to hearing both of you argue today and answer questions. But the time tends to go quickly. So if you will keep your eye on the clock as you proceed, we would appreciate that. So with that, we are ready for counsel for appellant to begin. So you can begin when you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the court. Eric Anunobi appears for the appellant. Your Honor, appellant Sermor Boaki was charged with 5 counts of offenses. And Your Honor, by September 25, there was a verdict against him of guilty by a jury. And Your Honor, he was sentenced on November 13. Your Honor, following that conviction, the appellant filed an appeal. And Your Honor, the issues on the appeal are laid out in our brief. And just a summary of the issues, Your Honor, is that the appellant's complaints about the relationship evidence that was admitted into the matter pursuant to a pretrial order that was given by the judge prior to the hearing. So a relationship evidence was admitted. Your Honor, the appellant also appeals against the joinder of offenses because the first time he was charged, it was with one charge. And then just close to the trial, 4 additional charges were brought. And the appellant appealed against that joinder because essentially they were prejudicial to him. Your Honor, the appellant also appeals against the pretrial ruling that was made by the judge prior to the trial without allowing the parties an opportunity to address her on this pretrial, especially when there were issues to be addressed and had been so filed by the parties. And then, Your Honor, the final argument is just the inference from the jurors, from the evidence that the jurors relied on in convicting him. And our argument is that while the court defers to the jury in terms of those findings, the inference from those findings, Your Honor, if they are not in tune with the findings, then the Court of Appeal has to intervene. And those are the issues before us, Your Honor. And I will address each of the issues directly, if the court will allow me. Yes, the first issue is about joinder. Your Honor, I've laid out the statutes and the case law on joinder. When the matter was when the additional charges were filed, the defendant opposed those additional charges, but the trial judge granted them anyway. Your Honor, the charges were prejudicial of the defendant. What the rule says, Your Honor, is that joinder cannot happen when it arises from a single behavioral issue, it can be joined. But when it's a series of incidents that are unconnected in time and place, it cannot happen. And Your Honor, our argument here was that the defendant's charges did not relate to the same time and place. Essentially, there were incidents that were alleged to have happened at different times, not in the same environment. They were not part of a single behavioral conduct. And that is what the joinder statute says, and court decisions on that in that regard say. That
so, counsel, can I just interrupt you and ask you a couple of questions about that, please, sir? It seems to me that the district court judge and then at trial made some findings about how the allegations with respect to each of the separate incidents that occurred were with respect to the same victim, that all of the incidents occurred at the same time in the middle of the night, and all of the incidents occurred in her bedroom while she was asleep or ostensibly asleep. And so my question to you, sir, is why aren't those circumstances, which are attributable to each of the different charges, why aren't those a unity of time and place sufficient to allow a district court in its discretion to join these charges in a single trial?
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, these incidents occurred allegedly between 2017 and 2019. In two of the latter charges, they don't even stipulate a time. They say something like between 2016, and it ends there. Another one says between 2017. There is nothing that shows that these incidents were all connected in time. We're all going from time to time, you know, regarding the charges. The second issue is that they did not occur in the same place, in the same location. One was alleged to have occurred in a prior house on Evan Avenue. Another one was alleged to have occurred in the new house, I think it's Winchester Avenue. So these incidents did not occur at the same time, in the same place. They were not part of a pattern of incidents going on particular dates. The state merely speculated by making the charges to read between this period and that period. There were no specific allegations that this incident happened on a particular date and they happened with a uniformity of time. That was not the case, Your Honor. So the most important thing, Your Honor, was that this incident made out the defendant to look like a very bad person who keeps on committing crimes, who never stops, that goes on from every day from 2016 to 2017, to 2019, which was the day of the last charge that brought him to court. That was unfairly prejudicial because there was really nothing to show that these incidents happened on specific days from 2016 to 2019. And that is our case, Your Honor. And especially because the statute says that there should be some kind of behavioral conduct of somebody. If somebody commits a crime here, for example, somebody commits an assault and drives off and hits somebody with a car and goes out from there and does something else, it's all part of a behavioral conduct. It's all part of the same behavioral conduct. That's our position, Your Honor. Your Honor, the second issue, if it's okay for me to go on, the second issue has to do with the issue of the relationship evidence. Your Honor, the relationship evidence was admitted without hearing any of the parties.
Can I ask you a question about that too, counsel? Yes, ma'am. Can you point me to where in the record there was an objection that you entered or trial counsel entered to the admission of the relationship evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Precisely, I filed a motion in limine, and that motion in limine is probably part of the addendum. I filed a motion in limine prior to the hearing, and the motion in limine was actually referred to in respondent's brief. I think it's what the motion in limine said was that the court should refrain from addressing any prior incidents involving the defendant, any prior allegations, any prior cases. Somehow, there was a word in there that was an error, and which ordinarily, if we had had a hearing of that motion in limine, would have been able to address that issue. But the trial judge did not allow us to have that hearing.
Is there somewhere in the rules, help me out here, counsel, is there somewhere in the rules of criminal procedure that requires a district court judge to hold a hearing to address those objections?
Your Honor, it's all about due process, Your Honor. When, even though there's no specific rule that says that, Your Honor, due process is about allowing the parties to come before the court and ventilate their cases, not for the courts to unilaterally make a decision. Because if the parties don't come out and argue on their cases, then it makes it difficult. There might be certain things that the judge does not see, that the parties will have made a difference coming. And in this case, Your Honor, it actually prejudiced the defendant. It actually went against the rules of evidence 403, the same things that the rules of evidence try to prevent, like prejudice to the defendant. It actually happened in this case. Because if we had a chance to explain to the court why we were bringing that motion, perhaps the court would have been much better guided in making a decision. Your Honor, this is against the background that even after we argued the severance case, we had asked the judge, we had mentioned to the judge about this remaining motion in limine. And the judge said, well, it's not for her to deal with it. Another judge will deal with it. But we didn't wait on that. We still wrote a letter to the chief judge of the state, asking him to please schedule a date for the hearing of these motions. And now what we saw was all of a sudden a decision had been given without us making an input into those decisions. And those substantially affected the defendant, Your Honor. That's our case here. Your Honor, I'll go on to the next issue. And the issue I'm going to go about is the inferences from the evidence. Your Honor, I laid out a whole bunch of circumstances that do not justify the decision of the jury. Now, even if the jury came to findings, the inference of guilt cannot be inferred from those findings. And those issues are contained in my respondent's brief, Your Honor. Those issues are quite a lot. And part of it is, first of all, there was evidence that the defendant and the victim were not in good terms. There was a high conflict environment. Your Honor, this same victim had actually called the police for the respondent in 2018 to report a domestic incident. And after calling the police, had been assigned a caseworker. So this victim did not discuss with the caseworker, did not discuss with the police on all of these issues. And yet it could be believed that all these incidents could have been happening over the years without this victim talking to the caseworker, talking to the police, the same person that called the police for the defendant. You know, beyond that, is also the fact that there were contradictions in what the victim and her sister said, material contradictions, and when they were in a position to know what the situation was. You know, the other issues are about the fact of even the caseworker herself admitted that she was surprised, that she had never seen a kind of thing like this. How would a man who faces hostility from the victim and her younger sister go into the bedroom of these children to touch them? What does he get from that? And if he goes into a place of high risk where he could be in a lot of trouble, what does he gain from that? He's not a pervert. So, Your Honor, these circumstances, plus the fact that the victim's testimony, sometimes she will mention her chest, sometimes she will mention her nipple, sometimes she will mention somewhere close to her nipple, was all materially contradictory. The fact also, Your Honor, that the victim's boyfriend, who was working with her on all these things, actually called the police and asked them, would this man be convicted for a misdemeanor or a felony? The fact that the victim's boyfriend's testimony or evidence materially contradicted the victim's own testimony of what happened on the day of the incident that led to the man's arrest. The victim's boyfriend says that, you know, the defendant was busy working his way from the legs all the way up to the upper part of the victim's body until he touched her. The victim said no, that she was lying on the bed, and immediately, while the man was coming, she was watching him. Immediately, he comes towards the bed to touch the bed cover. She screams. So how do we account for those material contradictions? You know, in spite of the fact that there was evidence that the victim, and this is evidence from the victim herself and the sisters, that they were not happy that this man was coming back to the house, was being allowed to the house by their mother. They were not happy about that. There's also evidence that as a result of all these factors, Your Honor, this victim and the boyfriend now began to live together. Immediately, the man was away. First of all, the victim admitted that after the man was taken away from the house, the boyfriend now comes and sleeps in the house. After all of that, at the time of the trial, the victim and the boyfriend are now living together. So, Your Honor, the whole situation as it was, the inference that should be drawn from it, not just the findings of the jury, but the inference from those findings should show, Your Honor, that this man's guilt cannot be proved beyond reasonable doubt. The last thing I was going to mention, Your Honor, was the police involvement in this matter. There was evidence that the police took a position without even investigating the case. They had begun to tell the victim's mother falsehood that had not been proved. They had begun to speak to the victim to say things that were inappropriate about the defendant. They had now begun to tell the victim's mother what to do and what not to do. It's all laid out in a brief, Your Honor. The involvement of the police created a situation where it was very easy for this man to be a victim of circumstances. And so all I'm trying to show, Your Honor, is that if you look at the inference that the juries drew from all of these factors, it does not show the guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Your Honor, I'm not even saying guilt or something close to that. I'm saying guilt beyond reasonable doubt, the standard required in a criminal case. And so, Your Honor, that is why I'm asking the court to look into this. And then finally, Your Honor, the last thing I wanted to mention was the admission of the unqualified expert testimony. The child protection worker, Ms. Amanda Hunter, was asked questions about what victims of rape do. And she had managed to say it before there was an objection. The jurors heard it. Your Honor, there was evidence. I mean, one of the jurors was a child, was a caseworker, and she had admitted to that during voir dire. Your Honor, this impression that the woman was an expert and that she could comment on the attitude of victims of crime was prejudicial to the defendant. And we're saying here that it actually caused the jury to actually begin to believe that this situation could have happened. And so looking at all the circumstances, Your Honor, I respectfully ask that the court should look into this and either order a retrial or dismiss this case, or at least allow the appeal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have anything else that you want to add? You've got 18 seconds left, but you also have 5 minutes for rebuttal, so.
Yes, Your Honor. That's all I have to say, Your Honor.
Okay. No, it sounds like there are no questions from the panel. Thank you. So counsel for respondent, we're resetting the clock. There we go. It's been reset and you can proceed with your argument when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm because the evidence supports the jury's verdicts and the district court's rulings were not reversible error. At this time, I'm happy to answer any questions that the panel may have on the various issues before the court today.
So, counsel, would you address the due process argument that appellant has made? So basically, as I understand it, it has to do with the failure to have a hearing on the in limine motions.
Right. The state's position is fairly simple, which is just that I don't see any legal authority or any basis to claim that there's a due process violation. The state
maybe you could help me out there. What's the rule of law as to when a hearing is required in a criminal case? Is it only for trial?
I think that when a party, needs to present, let's say, testimony on a contested issue, then obviously the court needs to allow the parties to have a hearing, but when there's not additional testimony that needs to be provided, then I don't think that there's any basis to find error when a district court might go ahead and rule on motions without having a hearing. In this particular case, the parties appeared in December of 2019 and the state had filed its motions in limine I don't know if it was a scheduling order or just if it was stated orally that the state filed them by the deadline. And so I imagine that if the parties were ready to litigate those motions at that time, that the district court, that's what the parties were there for, was for trial. They would have then litigated the motions right there and, added any oral argument that they wished to add. But in this particular case, because of the posture, appellant then asked for a continuance and was not prepared to address the motions in limine at that time and asked for additional time. And so I think that that's why oral argument wasn't heard at that time on that date. But I think otherwise the district court then felt it had all the information it needed to make the rulings. And looking at Judge Meyer's order, obviously a bunch of them are motions that wouldn't be decided until until they're in trial. They're evidentiary issues that would be decided during trial.
All right. And then I think the other point that was made by appellant is that the first issue related to admission, the prior relationship evidence, that the objection of the appellant was contained in the written motion in limine. So do you agree with that?
I disagree. I think that I understand based on appellant's reply brief that perhaps the word except was, he's saying is that was a mistake, a typographical error in the motion in limine. But based on the record that it was before the district court, it would have appeared that appellant was in agreement with that particular piece of evidence coming in. And so it would essentially, based on the filings, look to be in agreement that this particular incident was coming in at trial. And I would note that, obviously this would be after the fact, but that inference, that conclusion is supported not just by what appellant's motion in limine says in its very words, but also the fact that appellant really used that evidence at trial, either in cross-examination and in closing, more than the state did.
Ms. Folks, would you address the motion to sever, please? And in particular, I really want to focus on whether or not these incidents were connected in time and place. And there's a lot of case law talking about how the time and place factor, they often will look at the time between the incidents. So in other words, whether or not it has occurred within a few hours of each other. But in this case, you have allegations of incidents that have occurred over the space of days, if not weeks or months. So how is that time and place element met in this case?
Sure. The state's position is that the analysis that Judge Gaetis did when considering the motion is correct in terms of the unity of time and place, and that, as described earlier, all of the offenses obviously happened at night, happened in the victim's bedroom. They do happen over the span of years, obviously, but that is, I would say, typically how these cases are charged. There's a whole obviously, there's a lot of authority for the state charging date ranges in child sexual abuse cases. As far as, you know, I think that there really is a wide variety of case law when it comes to joinder and severance, and you see sort of a wide variety of results. And I think that, you know, the fact that you do have cases like State versus Ivy, which the state cited in its brief, which happened over many months, and that, you know, those were fine to join. But obviously, there are cases that are talking more about hours or about days. And so there, it really is a very fact-specific inquiry. And so, you know, in it's the state's position that that unity of time and place, that it always happened at home, that it happened at night, that it happened in the victim's bedroom, and that it was the same victim in each case, really does constitute a unity of time and place. I also think that to find the contrary would sort of lead to just an untenable result, wherein child victims who of sexual assault, often the abuse happens over the course of years, as this court, I'm sure, is aware from the cases it sees, then the state would be in a position of filing, you know, maybe five or six different complaints to address the different time periods. And a victim would then be required to attempt to tell their narrative only as to the statutory time frame that fit, you know, so when they were under 13 or 13 to 15 and have to, you know, tell their story in a little chunk in each trial and have multiple trials. And so I don't think that that trying to parse out their narrative like that, stopping and starting at statutory timeframes, is realistic. Instead, a victim in any trial would tell their entire story, which would span different statutory timeframes.
Counsel, would you address appellant's argument that the denial of his motion to sever created unfair prejudice because it allowed the jury to just sort of group all of these events together?
Yes. So I think that the prejudice analysis, the case law is pretty clear that one of the main ways that prong is analyzed is whether the different offenses would be admissible in trials on each of the other offenses. So if they were severed, would this evidence from count two be admissible in a trial on count three? And what the district court judge found when doing that analysis is that she thought that these incidents would be admissible in trials on the other offenses because they would be admissible either as Spriegel evidence or, as the state contends, as relationship evidence. And so that seems to be the thrust of the analysis on the second prong in all of the case law, is whether or not the offenses would be admissible. And here the state's contention is that they would be. And then I think additionally that the jury instructions are clear about each time frame and proving beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of each particular offense. And so really the jury is only going to consider what, you know, what meets the elements for each of the particular offenses.
And he was acquitted on one of the offenses, correct?
Yes, he was acquitted on count one, which was the count that was not a time range, but was a specific date. And then he was found guilty on the specific date ranges. Yes. And if there are no further questions, the state would rest on its brief. And I would just respectfully request that this court affirm appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Yes. So we will reset the clock. And once there we have it, we've got 5 minutes for you and you can proceed, counsel, when you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll be very brief here. Your Honor, opposing counsel talks about, you know, how they set the time frames for these situations. And she talks about what happens in victim child assault cases. But Your Honor, if we look at the perspective of the defendant, a defendant in which who is charged with a crime, who for whom there is no specification about when the incident happened, there is no direct specification, there's no direct evidence. Your Honor, one of the issues I mentioned in my brief was that there were records from a police officer who went to the victim and kept asking the victim things like, please try to remember something, anything that we can use against him. Just try to remember. If it may have happened during the winter, you know, just think about anything that may have happened during the winter. The way you can relate to winter periods are snow. The way you can relate to spring period is when the whole environment is mushy and wet. And then summer when it's very, very hot. So try and look for something. And then the victim tells the police officer, well, I'll think of something, I'll get back to you. And ultimately, the victim brings up a story. You know, my issue is that, I mean, the issue here for the defendant, for the appellant, is that if this is the process that is being adopted to be able to craft a charge or a time frame from a charge, then it's very prejudicial to a defendant. It's very unfair to a defendant. And any kind of criminal prosecution over here will not be appropriate in the circumstances. You know, defendant believes in criminal justice and people should be held accountable. But at the end of the day, it's all about fairness, the rule of law, fairness, justice to every party involved, including the defendant. And so, Your Honor, that's all I have to say on this. Our point is that defendants did not get a fair treatment on all of these things. And defendant respectfully asks this court to please set aside this decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Don't see any questions from the panel. So with that, to both lawyers, our gratitude. We very much appreciate the briefs that you've submitted, the arguments that you've given us today, and the responses to our questions.